You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to Hot Texas band.
Yeah, and we're so delighted that you're joining us tonight, whether you're watching live, listening live, or maybe you're catching this on a podcast starting tomorrow. We're just happy that you're here riding along with us. Let's see, who's our guest tonight, Jim?
Our special guest, C.M. Wendelboe, Kurt to his friends.
Yes, howdy. Kurt to his friends. Happy. How are you?
How are you guys?
Doing good. Kurt, where are you joining us from?
Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Wyoming. Okay. Yeah. And we're going to be talking tonight about, now Kurt's written a lot of books, including one we won't have time to talk about, but I'm going to hold it up. Hunting the Mail Order Murderer. This was a really good book, another good read. But tonight we're going to be talking about Death Under the Deluge. And you want to have Kurt tell a little about himself, or are you just going to start?
Do you want to do the bio?
Oh, yeah, we'll do the bio. We'll do the bio.
We can't skip the bio. Okay, Kurt, of Cheyenne, Wyoming, is a prolific author of murder mysteries with a Western flair as well as traditional Westerns. He entered the law enforcement profession when he was discharged from the Marines as the Vietnam War was winding down. During his 38-year career in law enforcement, he served in various roles with several agencies, yet he always felt most proud of working the street. He was a patrol supervisor in Gillette, Wyoming, when he retired as a sheriff's deputy to pursue his true vocation as a fiction writer. Mm-hmm. All right.
So welcome. Do you want to, Kurt, would you like to tell us a little something else about yourself we wouldn't find in a bio or on your website?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, my first job out of the service was a small town in South Dakota. Actually, it's one that I used in Death Under the Deluge, and that was my first law enforcement job. And since then, I worked for three different agencies, and I picked up a lot of inside information along the way that I use in my books, and so I've kind of spoiled that away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When did you first start writing?
Oh God, you know, I was just a kid when I started writing. I'd hire out to different farms and things, and the one place I worked, I got $5 a day in found, and my found was the guy cleaned out a stall in his barn, and he set me up with a cot and a reading lamp and a chair. And And after I come out of the field every night, I'd read. And one night he came around. And he said, "You know, as much as you read, you should start writing." Yeah. And I did, but I didn't have anything published. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You did a seminar recently. I saw an interesting on Facebook. You promoted it. That you talked at that seminar, you were giving authors some tips on how to write about policing correctly. And it sounded like you covered some other things, the law from Wild West to contemporary times. I wish that I had been in that seminar. So would you maybe just share a little bit about what you talked about at that time?
Oh, sure. Yeah. A lot of the things that writers get wrong It's real easy to correct it. You know, as far as like police procedural, for example, it's as easy as, you know, going down to police department and talking to a cop, or maybe going into a citizen police academy, which is real popular across the country and things. Mm-hmm. And it's really easy to get all the facts right. It just takes a little bit of work with your LPCs, your leather personnel carriers, you know, your shoes, you know, beating the bushes and you know, talking to officers and stuff. But and most officers around the country are pretty approachable if you stop and talk about a particular subject, they'll visit with you. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
when do you need to bring donuts?
No.
No. Okay. So, you know, yeah. when we're watching any, you know, NCIS or any show, it seems mm-hmm. they can get DNA back really fast.
About 20 minutes?
Yeah, in about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Have you found that to be true?
Well, it all depends what the lab is and what the priorities are. Now, I've been retired for, 13 years, and about 6 or 7 months before I retired, I sent a sample in on the burglary to get analyzed for DNA, and I still haven't gotten word back that it's, you know, it's completed. So all of, you know, I mean, a lot of labs are just so inundated now with DNA samples and things, and you know, some of the larger agencies can handle it, but especially a lot of these smaller agencies in the West, smaller states, you know, they just can't handle that many.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
You know, we're talking about, you know, writing correctly when it comes to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. What are a couple of the biggest mistakes, or most often the mistakes a young writer might write?
I'll tell you, the easiest one to fix and the most common is when they start talking about weapons. Okay. Even an A-list writer, I read a couple of his books where, for example, his character took a safety off a Glock, which they don't have safeties.
Uh-huh. There you go.
But it's really easy to get that information correct. Mm-hmm. There's books out there, there's websites, it's just real easy to get that information correct. And mm-hmm. there's absolutely no reason the writers can't.
Mm-hmm. You bring up an interesting point, because mm-hmm. you are an author and you've written a number of books, lots mm-hmm. of different series, but you're also a reader. Mm-hmm. When you read, are you able to turn off the writer brain? You know, or is it editing while you read? Is it saying, no, Glocks don't have safeties? You know, are you able to enjoy the reading experience?
No, it seems like I can't enjoy it anymore unless I read the classics. Uh-huh. And a lot of the classics are so hard to read, you got to concentrate on them. But if I read another murder mystery, mm-hmm. I've always got them in the back of my mind, you know, do they have the procedure right? Or is characterization like you'd expect an investigator, for example, or a dispatcher or something, you know, mm-hmm. I just can't turn it off until I read the classics, and then it's hard.
I can imagine that. Yeah. You have written a number of series. Did you have another question?
No, I just sort of kind of tail in on that, what you're going to ask right now. You do have a lot of books out there.
Yes, you have a number of different series. And the Nelson Lane Frontier Mysteries series, I think a book has just recently been published or relaunched out of that series. Just something that just happened in March. You want to tell us about that?
See if I have it. Okay, this is Marshall and the Moon. I don't know if you can see it from the glare.
Yes, yeah, you can see it. Marshall and the Moonshiner, yes.
Yeah, and that takes place in the Great Depression, and I always thought that there's so much written about the gangsters in a depression area in the big cities, that there's so little written about rural law enforcement during that time. And so that's why I decided to set that in the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever happen to know anybody in that business?
Pardon?
Did you happen to know anybody in that business, the moonshining business?
Oh, no, I don't. No, that's, when I was in law enforcement, it was around South Dakota and Wyoming and stuff. The Whirler wasn't any, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you have the Tucker Ashley Western series.
Yes.
Is that, so Tucker Ashley, is that the main character that's in each one of
the books? Yes. Yeah, that's it's set in the Dakota Territories in the 1870s, and Tucker Ashley is my main character, and I actually talked with him about 6 weeks ago. His daughter called me up and said, "My dad's name is Tucker Ashley."
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, and so I talked to him over the phone, and he hunted with my old police chief in South Dakota.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, so he was around that area, and I never knew the guy, except that someplace along the back of my mind, I must have put that name. Because it's a strong name,
yeah.
And I figured, well, someday I'll use it, and I did. And so I was kind of odd talking to one of my characters.
It's kind of unique.
Well, yeah. Especially since it was a real person, because we know that actors do often talk to your characters, but they're still not sitting on the phone with you. Oh, fun. And then another series is the Spirit Road mystery series, of which this book we're going to be getting in greater detail about is from. What sets this series apart from the others?
Well, it's that series is all set on Indian reservations, and it's contemporary. Mm-hmm. And when I was working around in South Dakota, I worked close to a couple of reservations, some of the BIA guys that come in, and FBI and things like that. And I always thought, I wonder how many Lakota FBI agents the Bureau has. And years later, when I decided to write that series, I got to check and I didn't have any. So I thought, I'm going to give the Bureau a Lakota FBI agent. So that's my main character. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm able to go with, different reservations because he has federal jurisdiction. I go in Pine Ridge for the first couple and then up the Crow Agency where Custer Battlefield is, and Wind River Reservation, and back to Pine Ridge. And so I'm able to move around quite a bit with my characters.
Did you have another question?
No, are we ready to talk about the book?
I think what we're going to do, I'm just looking at time, and you know what I think we'll do is we're going to just take a very short break, and then when we come back, we are talking about this book. In the meantime, here is a place that you can get all of Kurt's books, as well as many of the books of our authors of Rendezvous with a Writer. It's our Out West Shop Bookshop affiliate page. Stay right where you are. We will be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guest, Kurt Winnebo. And we're just about ready to talk about Death Under the Deluge.
Yeah, so this is a very gripping cover, Kurt. Tell us a little bit about how the cover came to be and maybe why you chose the title.
Well, my wife's really handy with coming up with titles, and so she came up with the title. And she's really handy with photographs. She's a pretty good photographer, and so she took a couple pictures and composited them. And Death Under Deluge, the deluge being when the Corps of Engineers wanted to make Lake Francis Case back in the 50s in the Missouri River, they had to flood the whole thing. And at that time, there's a little island that Lewis and Clark found on their Corps of Expedition discovery in 1805-1806, and through the years, that American island had developed into a resort. They had cabins there, and they had ice cream parlors and places for the kids to play ball, and it was kind of cool. You took a ferry out there and things. Well, that was going to be flooded, and I thought, what better place to shackle one of my victims in an old cabin that's going to get flooded? And so that's where that idea came up.
So that's a little bit of the storyline, and it's not really a spoiler alert exactly, because we discovered that skeleton. What is it? The wrist that is shackled to cabin, and there's some boys in the water kind of playing around or diving around that find that. And it's like the opening of an NCIS episode.
Well, yeah, because you get this hand sticking above the water, you know, right?
Yeah.
what is that?
kind of waving goodbye. Huh?
Yeah, or hello in this case. When the book opens, a little before we get to that scene, but that scene comes up pretty quickly. But when the book opens, we have two gentlemen, Manny Tano, and he's your FBI detective, and he's out with his friend Willie, right? Mm-hmm. And they're sightseeing. They're taking a little vacation, and Manny has some memories of carnival games. They're at the Corn Palace. I had to look up the Corn Palace. I was so curious. Yeah. It's like I'd heard of the Corn Palace, but I couldn't really remember. Tell us a little bit about the Corn Palace. It's pretty cool.
Well, the Corn Palace, the locals call it the world's biggest bird feeder. What they do is the university students draw murals on paper, and then the murals are tacked up on the side of this huge building. And then the workers spend a couple months, and they take Indian corn of different colors depending on what the mural is, and they tack this Indian corn up on the side, and it looks great when it gets done. It's just something else, but it's a large building, and it's been there since the 1894 maybe. But it's just really an interesting building, because every year they have different murals that they put up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Manny has the memories of carnival games. Mm-hmm. Wait, is it Manny? Yeah, Manny has memories of carnival games.
Yeah.
And we both enjoyed reading that quite a bit. And I think you wanted to ask about our fraud, carnival games and fraud.
You always wondered why you could never win anything. You won one of those Cupid dolls, you know, one of those stuffed animals. Yeah, okay, I'm going to get that one over there, you know. And you try to knock down milk bottles, you're trying to shoot a target with a BB gun, and you never hit anything.
Nope. No, there's just a lot of different ways that they tweak it so to make sure a person doesn't win.
Yeah.
And I worked carnival fraud a couple of different times and things. And I came away that one time I must have had 20 teddy bears or something I was trying to hang on to, because I was winning a lot because I knew how they rigged the thing. And so,
I
gotta say, I assume they would try to chase you away if, you know, this carnival guy, you know, if you all of a sudden you're starting to win prizes, they think, oh, well, we can't have this.
Yeah. Yep. Stay away from carnival games.
It's like the card counters in the casinos, I guess. They figure out pretty quick if you're a card counter or not.
Well, you mentioned about, you know, we were talking about the BB guns, and you mentioned how they change the sights around a little bit. And that kind of explains why that, you know, you think, well, I could hit something at least once in a while, and then you can't even hit the outside of a bar. And you think, what?
Yeah, you're thinking you're a good shot, and it's halfway off the papers.
So this mystery, you know, I think as we're readers, you know this, we're not writers, we're readers. And so we read for entertainment, and we also like to learn things when we're reading. It's fun to have some things come in that we wouldn't necessarily know. Mm-hmm. You introduce Lakota code talkers, World War II. It's a major part of the story. And I thought it was so very interesting because I think mostly I have thought that the code talkers were Navajo. Yes. I didn't really know that we had different, you know, Native American language code talkers in helping out with what went on in World War II. Would you talk a little bit about the Lakota code talkers and how you brought them into the story?
Well, like I said, though, we normally think of code talkers being Navajo, only because the Marine Corps used them really extensively in the Pacific. But there was actually 19 different tribes throughout the war that used their native language to confound the enemy. And the Lakota code talkers were attached to the Army in the Pacific. And so I have a couple of my code talkers go back with MacArthur when he goes back into the Philippines and starts that campaign there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they weren't working alone. I mean, they were like a team. And I thought that was very interesting, too. Mm-hmm. We have in this case, we have Robbie Bearpaw and Amos Willowbent. And then we have a Lieutenant Charles McKnight.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked together. When they were out doing their job, how did the three of them interrelate together? What were their jobs?
Well, Lieutenant McKnight's job was to make sure that the code talker didn't get into enemy hands. Now, whether that's being a security man or putting a cap and one in the back of his head is, you know, depending on what the circumstances was. But the code talker out in the field would relay information back in his native tongue to another code talker back in the rear who would get it transcribed, and then it pass it on to a headquarters company and make the decision what to do then. So that was how the three of them worked together.
Yeah,
there's not many of these fellows left, right?
No, I don't know if there's any Lakota code talkers left. And Navajo, there may be one or two is all. Not very many.
Mm-hmm.
Fellows that have to be over 100 years old at this point. So,
Yeah.
You know, we start with this hand sticking out of the water, which is really kind of a bony finger, you know, to speak of.
Yeah.
And we got this, which appears to be maybe a crime we need to solve. You know, when you approach writing the book, did you have all the different directions that come together in this book? Did you have them all planted in your mind? Or did you thought, well, I'll just start out here and see how it goes?
You're asking me if I'm a pantser or a plotter? Is that what you're asking?
Not quite, but...
I'm definitely a plotter. You know, if I drive out to Los Angeles and I know how to get there, but I'll still use a map. You know, maybe now and again I'll take a little side trip over to see something interesting, but I'll use a map to stay on track. And a few years ago, I wanted to write three different novels at once. And wow. Yeah. Okay. And I, one was, and there's all three different eras. One was in the set in the Great Depression. One was set in the Old West, and one was contemporary. And so I went on a writer's forum, and I asked, I said, is there any suggestions? And everybody said, well, you know, that's about the dumbest damn thing I ever heard, trying to do three at once. But then they came up with some ideas. Maybe I should take a tip from the method actors, where they get in the costume. And so I thought, you know, I've got Western outfit garb, I've got modern garb, and I've got, you know, there's enough antique stores here that I could find some Depression era. And I just put that, you know, particular clothes on, and I'd write it. But then I got thinking, the only burr on the saddle of that is one of my voices in my Western is a woman. And I got thinking, well, you know, I guess I can find a dress that'll fit, I guess. But I'm going to draw the line at the accessories. I'm not going to wear any accessories. But then I thought, oh my gosh, about the time I'm in my computer wearing a dress, writing this woman's voice, that the UPS man or FedEx or somebody comes, and then I've got to go and sign for it, and get around a neighborhood. And so how I end up doing it is I got thousands of old periodicals and stuff in my collection, and so I just read for a little bit on a particular era, and then I'd write, and then I'd write for 3-4 hours, and then I'd take a break, and then write that way. So
that's so interesting. Yeah. So in this mystery, this body, the skeleton that we find is found, is wearing dog tags. And they don't make a lot of sense, because the dog tags are for somebody else that it's like, you know, there's a mix up of some kind with dog tags. Did you plan that from the beginning, or was that something as you wrote along, you thought, oh, you know what? Yeah. I got to go back. And then you tell us, the author, Manny, I think, helps us understand the difference between dog tags from particular period of time and the more contemporary dog tag. That was so interesting. So did you know all along you were going to have that mix up, or did you have to go back and plant that?
No, I knew from the beginning, and I really agonized about the clues. You know, I thought, man, you know, I want to give enough information, but I want to be fair about it. And so the dog tags were one of those that if you went on the internet and you know, researched dog tags from that era or something, you could have found exactly what I put in the book.
Yeah.
But I planned that from the beginning, just to fool folks. Sorry.
Sure. Well, there were a few red herrings.
Yeah, you know, in your law enforcement career, did you ever have a case that was a little like this?
No. Well, when I worked around Missouri, we had at least once or twice summer we'd have drowning victims, and when they, you know, I don't mean to be too graphic and stuff, but after they popped up, well, most of them had to have autopsies done because they wasn't witnessing things, and I was able to take in quite a few autopsies. You know, people don't normally think of that as entertainment and stuff, but well, I tell you, from law enforcement perspective, every autopsy, you learn something different. So. Sure.
Is the first one you attend, or the first one that you you watch, your is that a tough scene for you?
Your first one.
Well, yeah, like I said, the first one, he was submerged for several months before, you know, before the river current brought him up and stuff, and that was a. It was a really eye opener, that first one.
You have quite a cast of characters in this book. and different ages and different backgrounds. And I'm just going to throw out a name, and if you could just give a little something about. So we mentioned, we've already mentioned Robbie and Amos and Lieutenant Charles McKnight, but tell us a little bit specifically, really, about Robbie and Amos. These are two really neat guys.
Yeah, yeah. Robbie and Amos were both Lakota code talkers in the Pacific in 1945, and. So they worked. They often worked as a team, and with McKnight going out as a security person, they all kind of worked together that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then when they come back from the war, Robbie starts a business.
Yeah, he started a trucking business, and Amos he started a bull ranch in on the reservation, and McKnight, he was kind of a ne'er-do-well. He runs some drugs and he runs some shady operations down in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And so, mm-hmm. So the two code talkers were on the up and up, but McKnight wasn't. He mm-hmm. kind of a shyster.
Mm-hmm. Manny's brother, Reuben.
I love Reuben as a character.
Yeah.
And he's about 15 years older than Manny, but he's a felon. He's an ex-felon. He spent 25 years in the South Dakota pen for a homicide connected with the American Indian Movement. And Reuben was a aim enforcer back when they was really going strong American Indian Movement. And but now he's pretty much on the up and up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he kind of does stuff under the table. It's something that Manny really doesn't want to witness. But you know, he's all in all, he's kind of a good guy.
Yeah, and he's needed. You know, yeah. He and Willie are two guys that we kind of need them in the story. You know,
yeah.
Willie and his wife Doreen, and they have a funny scene with their sort of young infant daughter Precious that suddenly Willie is going to have to take care of, and that's that was a moment of levity in the book.
yeah brought back memories.
Did it?
Yep.
Where do you get that name, Willie the Horn?
That's right, that's his actual type name, I think, right?
Oh, Willie Withorn. I just Withorn's a fairly common name on the Crow Creek Reservation.
Okay.
And he moved to Pine Ridge, and so the Withorn name isn't too common there. But so I wanted to give him something different that people wouldn't normally identify with.
Now we have Robbie Bearpaw's daughter Annie, mm-hmm. And her son Miles.
Yes.
You want to say a little something about Annie and Miles?
Annie, when Robbie retired, he turned the business over to his daughter Annie. Well, working with a bunch of truck drivers and stuff, they can get kind of rowdy, kind of out of hand, and so Miles helps out, and Miles is kind of a shyster. Likes to fight. And. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't mind being in that role of, I guess, an enforcer for the trucking company.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
He seems like he enjoys that job.
Do you want to ask the question you love to ask about characters? You know, do they ever surprise?
Yeah, are we ready for that one?
Sure.
You know, do you have total control of these guys, these characters, or did they ever surprise you?
Well, you know, if I do my plotting right, they pretty well gotta stay in lockstep. But sometimes they'll kind of get off over at a tangent that I hadn't planned on.
Uh-huh.
And but you know, I can't do much about that. You know, if I can try to rein them back in, and sometimes they do, and sometimes wherever they go is legitimate.
Yeah.
And so I.
Well, and there's a character, Emily she's a minor character. I like her, Emily Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. And she's the night manager of the Best Western Motel. But I think she and Ruben, I kind of thought, you know, I wonder, she's not necessarily that important, but she's like, did she announce herself to you, Kurt, and say, I want to be in this story? Or
Well, I needed somebody for a distraction. And Manny at this point is married. He got married last mm-hmm. book. And so he doesn't want to mess around, but Emily's kind of a flirt.
Yeah.
And so I needed a flirt.
So. That must be kind of fun sometimes, putting in a character like that.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And sometimes I'll meet somebody. I think, man, that'd be it's a real good character in the book. Mm-hmm. And so I'll use him.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I wondered about Freddie, the owner of the bar that's called the D&D. What does mm-hmm. D&D stand for in that bar's name? Do you remember?
Death and Destruction.
Death and Destruction.
That's right. That's right. That's what it was. Yeah.
Yep. And when I was a cop there, that was mainly a bar that the Indians went in.
So we
called it Death and Destruction, and we got more bar fights out of that thing than all the rest of them combined.
Yeah, because Freddy's another kind of an interesting character. He's not in the book, you know, but when he's in the book or we're in that bar. Oh, Blatt's. Oh, you want to tell us about Blatt's beer?
There's quite a few different, brands of beer that you probably wouldn't normally drink, like Blatt's and Grain Belt and Hams, Pfeiffer's, some of these real cheap beers and stuff. But I thought, well, nobody ever gives Blatt's a thought. What the heck, I'm gonna give him some business. So that's why I'm crazy to bring Blatt's.
Yeah.
I remember Blatt's. But that was a long time ago. I thought, Blatt's, where would you find Blatt's today? And it wasn't necessarily my favorite beer, so.
No.
Yeah. Here's a question. This is, of course, the only book of the series that we've read. How many of the characters in this series have been in the other books? Is just Manny and like Ruben, his brother, or?
Yeah, it was Manny and Ruben. There's been a couple, and Willie.
And Willie.
Willie's tribal cop. His boss is Lumpy.
Okay.
I call him Lumpy because he's got a couple lumps. He's a little bit overweight. And the old police chief, Chief Horn. He's in most of them. So. Most, but probably half my characters I use from some.
Use, yeah, book you to use book. Them again. Yeah. We're going to, do you want to, Kurt, we are so delighted to have you with us. And of course, you found us through a mutual friend, the Blue Cottage Agency. And we would like to just put a call out there to our listeners. If you would like to sit in Kurt's seat and be a guest on Rendezvous with a Writer, what do they do?
What do they do? They get a hold of you, right?
Yes. You get a hold of me. So if you're an author, a songwriter, a poet, if you're a literary agent, if you're a publicist, if you're with a publishing house, and you think that you have someone in mind that would love to be on the show, just send me an email at bobbyjeanbell@gmail.com and just tell me a little bit about yourself or your book or your music or whatever, and then we'll take it from there.
Right. And if anybody out there would like to kind of, get a spot on the show and advertise their products or their company, they can do the same thing. Just send an email to Bobby.
Send me an email and we'll talk about it. So, So I think did we cover that pretty good?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're done. We're going to move back to the book.
Okay. Back to the book. Let's see. We don't want to give away a lot of, there's lots of great action. This was a wonderful book. We totally enjoyed it. We found it many often on the edge of my seat, not able to go to bed because I had to know what happened next. And but we don't want to give things away. We want you to get the book and read it. How about a little bit more on your writing process, Kurt? What about writing dialogue? Is that easy, not easy? How does that come to you?
Well, no, it's always come pretty easy, only because I talk to my characters, you know, like Manny. Manny was with me on so many calls. And, you know, I talked to him as he was going to a call. Well, how should we do this? And after a call, we critique it together. Mm-hmm. And if anybody was sitting in my squad car when I was doing that, they'd think I was nuts. You know, talking about that. But, I'll talk my characters out loud because that's the only way you can catch a lot of the things that maybe they wouldn't say or inflections that they should say.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And when you're writing dialogue for the reader, that's sometimes where we find the clues.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, especially, you know, when I'm writing some of the Lakota dialogue. I put some in there, but I don't want to put enough that'd be distracting.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah. And Manny has an interesting background because in, I guess maybe in another book, he knows about our stolen antiquities. He has some knowledge of theft of antiquities or, older collectible kinds of things in his background. And I thought, oh, that's also interesting. He's kind of, you know, he's very well rounded in expertise in a lot of the areas that this book touches on.
Well, you know, people read, like I say, for enjoyment, but they also read to learn something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least I do. Even fiction, I want to learn. I want to learn something.
Yeah.
And so one of the Spirit Road books, I have Manny going up to the Crow Agency, and up there there's some theft of a bunch of antiquities.
Okay.
And that's where he gets that.
And that's where
that,
he gets
that expertise. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you need to do a lot of research for the book? Well,
yeah, I do. I do actually quite a bit of research for every book, but I don't probably only use maybe 10%, if that. But it's really interesting because I like research, but I got to be careful as I don't get in that rabbit hole of Wikipedia where you keep clicking on links and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Do you go to the locations that you write about?
Yes, I do. And it's like this sort of book we talk about the antiquities and Indian artifacts that was stolen. I went up to Crow Agency to do some research, and I was at the college up there, and I had my Stetson on with a real nice hat band, and the librarian said, that's a heck of a hat band you got there. I said, yeah, it's I like it, don't you? He said, well, that's a Lakota style hat band. He said, look it over there, and there was three big old bruises over a table giving me the glare, and I didn't the Crow and the Lakota were like enemies back in the day, mm-hmm. and I just didn't realize that it's still that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the hat band off, made a run for the border, let me tell you. No.
You know, it's interesting you say that, Kurt, because many years ago we went to a symposium up at the battlefield, a little Bighorn. And of course, there was some serious discussion between the Lakota and the Crow. Mm-hmm. So that's when we first found out that, there was some animosity there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which we didn't. You don't necessarily pick it up in all of the nonfiction that we read to prepare to go to that event. We read all the books by all of the historians that were presenting. And I didn't really feel like I had picked up that. Anyway, that's a whole nother dialogue for another time.
Yep.
When do you write? And do you have a favorite place you like to write?
Well, I have a cave. I call it my cave, If I pan the camera, you see just how disorganized it is.
I don't know. It looks pretty organized, what we can see.
Well, that's a small part disorganized, but yeah, I like to write. I shoot for 12 hours a day, but if I get 10 hours, that's fine.
You do.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how many are you working on? One book now, or are you working on multiple projects right now?
Yeah, I'm working on multiple projects. Mm-hmm. I have another Bitter Wind book that's coming out in Circle. That's going to be in November.
Okay.
And I just had a Golden West just re-released, one of my Westerns, and I'm working on another Spirit Road book, and I'm doing a Judging for Killer Nashville. So I've got.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, for Killer Nashville. Oh, how fun. You're a judge for that. Oh, how fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where can people find you, Kurt? Where do they go?
Well, my website is cmwendelbo.com, and I have all my books on there and things. Then, you know, they can buy them through you, which you guys would prefer.
Oh, no, we just want readers to get them in their hands.
Well, they always go to Barnes and Noble. I can't quite get it out, but Amazon.
Yeah. We just want readers to read, and we want them to get it in their hands and go to their favorite place. If you have a local bookstore in your town that you love to support, go in and say, hey, I want to get these books, and they'll take care of you. It's really, we just want readers to find you.
Yeah. And I really like independent bookstores too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, we have one in town here, the Book Rack, and a chain bookstore, you go in and they'll kind of point you towards the mystery section or the romance section or something. But independent bookstores, they'll actually kind of come up to you and say, mystery, what kind of mystery you like, and kind of steer you towards.
Yeah, we love independence. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
we do.
Jim has a quote to read.
We do.
We do. He has a quote from the book to read.
This is a quote from our FBI fellow, Manny, and he's visiting the Corn Palace, which we were talking about earlier, and he gets this terrifying vision. Manny felt his legs buckle, and he put his head between his legs for a moment, his hands resting on shaky knees. When he looked back up at the side of the building, the mural was still there, taunting him. Manny heard the sound of water approaching, louder than anything he'd ever heard. He clamped his hands over his ears and slumped to his knees, screams overriding the sounds of the deluge. Get out of there, he screamed. Run. And the last thing he saw was a mural undulating as if alive, as if it was telling him something he could not decipher. I guess sets the stage for the whole book,
Well, thank you, Kurt, so much for being with us tonight. And
oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you to all of you that listened and for writing along with us. Thank you to Sam Hassan and LA Talk Radio, who makes this show possible for it to be so professionally produced. And who else do we need to thank? Oh, if you want to catch this, I will be getting it up on Podbean shortly, and then it'll go out to Spotify and Amazon Music and all your favorite channels. You just have to give me a little time to get it up there. So I think, thank you.
And next week?
And next week. That's right. So April, Kurt's book took us out with a bang. This concludes our April programming. And in May, next week, we start off with Nancy Elliott, Autumn's on Its Way. Nancy's a singer-songwriter, and this is her first book, and it's really terrific. She'll be joined by Henry Park, who's with us the first Thursday of every month. And this is his book on the greatest Westerns ever made and the people who made them. The following week, R.G. Yoho, Bob to his friends. We're very excited. We'll be talking about two books. One of them is Bitter Water. Then the following week, Adam Sykes, we will be, the following week actually is Jim Overstreet, and we'll be talking about two of his books. Then we're into thriller espionage with two books by Adam Sykes, his newest, The Underhanded. And then we finish the month with Ann Schroeder. We'll be talking about two of her books and her newest, Crossroads in Casa Corte. So tune in again next week. We'll see you here.
And remember, it's always a great day out west.
Keep reading.
Thanks, Kurt.